Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew DeClaire, and you are listening to Equal Time for Free Thought, the show that explores and promotes humanism, scientific naturalism, and critical thinking. We have a guest today. Her name is Catherine Stewart. And as a journalist, Ms. Stewart's work has appeared in the New York Times, Newsweek, The Rolling Stone, The Village Voice, and more. She has also published two novels, co-authored a book on Rent, the musical, and has written the book which shall be the topic of today's show, The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. So thanks for coming on the show again today. We had you on a little while ago, but it ended up being the one show that, for whatever reason, didn't end up getting officially recorded into our system for the 10 years or so that we've had this show. So it's good to have you back on, and this way we'll have a record of our discussion here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me back. It's great to see you again.
Sure. Yeah, and this time we could see each other too. We're using Skype in order to do this interview, and since our studios are having a little bit of trouble in uptown New York today, I'm recording here from my apartment. So here's the book, The Good News Club. The Good News Club sounds like a good club. It doesn't sound like it's all that offensive. What exactly is The Good News Club, and how did you first come around to hear about it?
Well, when I first heard about Good News Clubs, my reaction was very much like yours. I thought, what could be wrong with a group or with such a very innocuous name? I was living at the time in Santa Barbara, California, with my husband, our baby boy, and our daughter, who was a six-year-old, and I heard from another mother that a Good News Club was coming to our family's, you know, our daughter's public elementary school as an after-school club. So I just thought this is no big deal. But, you know, I learned then that the group was promising after-school Bible study from a non-denominational standpoint. But perhaps I was very innocent. I thought non-denominational meant non-sectarian. I thought they were going to teach about the Bible, you know, from a non-sectarian standpoint. And I think the Bible is certainly an important text and perhaps should be taught in public schools as history or literature or anthropology. But I started to hear stories from parents in town whose kids went to public elementary schools where Good News Clubs had already been established. And I started to hear about how kids attending the clubs were targeting their peers, what I could only describe as faith-based bullying and bigotry. There's a little girl that we know her family, and she was on the playground when one of her classmates, who had just started attending a Good News Club, approached her and said, "You don't believe in Jesus, so you're going to go to hell." And this other little girl who had just started attending the Good News Club started kind of berating her. She had sort of determined that our friend's daughter was not being raised in a Christian household. And so this little girl, Zoe, said, "That's not true." And you know, remember, these are six-year-olds. Yeah. So she got a little heated on the playground, and the teacher overheard the exchange and decided to use this as a teachable moment. She explained that different religions have different perspectives on these different issues. So Zoe, the little girl that we knew, was completely fine with it. But the other little girl who had started attending the club was devastated, and she started to cry. She sobbed sort of uncontrollably, and she said, "How can this be? I know it must be true because they taught it to me in school." Mm. And teach things in school that aren't true. Now, this story gets to the heart of the trouble with Good News Clubs. I don't have a problem with kids having discussions with their friends about religion at school, but I do have a problem with children being deceived into thinking that their school favors a particular religion and being told to use that fraudulent misperception in order to try to convert and bully their peers. And see, that misperception on the part of these children is not an accident. Good News Club leaders know that little kids cannot distinguish between an activity that takes place in their school and one that is sponsored by their school. And that's why they're so insistent on establishing these Good News Clubs in public elementary schools. And remember, we're talking little kids here. You know, elementary Good News Clubs are not in high schools. They're in elementary schools. That's K through six. Mm. So you're talking kids who are 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. For those little kids, if it takes place in their school, they think that that must be what their school and the state wants them to believe. Now, some interesting things happened when the Good News Club came, announced it was coming to our daughter's public elementary school. A number of parents who were affiliated with an evangelical college, which was just up the road, We had this very lovely under 200 kids public school, and it was in the same zone as an evangelical college, so we had a very heavy evangelical presence. But it seemed that no one there wanted them in either. And so a bunch of the moms who were affiliated with that evangelical college, they were either professors or wives of professors, they met with the leaders of the Good News Clubs and they said, "We know you mean well. We're evangelical too, but you're just not right for our school because it's going to be very divisive. We really do love our neighbors after all. We want them to feel comfortable in their public school. So we'd like to offer you free space in the Montecito Covenant Church, this evangelical church literally next door to the school. So the space was free and it was better space. And frankly, this is probably one of the most beautiful churches in the country. I mean, it's just stunningly gorgeous. And the Good News Club leaders declined. They insisted that they be in the public school because they know very well that little kids cannot distinguish between an activity that takes place in their school and one that's sponsored by their school. So this whole experience started me to ask some more questions about the Good News Club. I thought, who are these people, and what do they really believe, and why do they want to be in our public school if the church next door is available to them, and everybody seems to want them to be there, and how is what they're doing really legal and consistent with the constitutional principle of separation of church and state? So I spent a couple of years researching the Good News Club and their true beliefs, and I went to Good News Clubs around the country, and I went to a convention that their leaders held in Alabama, so I could really hear what the leaders had to say, and went to their training sessions and joined a mission project in Boston, and that's the results of which I put in my book, The Good News Club.
This is a club that goes into an elementary school, and that in itself struck me as odd only because, from what I usually hear, Christian clubs are formed in schools like high schools, and they're formed by kids who actually want it there, or at least they're encouraged. The kids are encouraged to form a club by maybe some adults, but I had never heard before of an elementary school having clubs like this. So one of the things that I learned through my experiences in a high school was that clubs, at least in the high schools, they must be student-led.
Yes, indeed. That's very different from Good News Clubs.
How do they
You're right.
avoid that?
Well, it's all because of a 2001 decision in which it's called Good News Club versus Milford Central School, in which the Supreme Court ruled that religion is nothing more than speech from a certain point of view. And therefore, to exclude these activities in the public schools is to discriminate against the religious viewpoint of these clubs. Now, it bears a question, asking the question, is religion nothing more than speech from a certain point of view? Is religion just speech? Well, if it were, religion would be taxed the same way that other forms of speech are taxed. Religions, as you well know, have significant exemptions from the tax code. They receive tens of billions of dollars per year in
Right.
subsidies. Our legal code also doesn't treat religion as just speech from a certain point of view. Religions are excluded, for instance, from anti-discrimination laws that other forms of speech are subject to. And more to the point, I mean, religions, including the religion of the Good News Club, are free to perpetuate the kind of bigotry for which they are rightly excluded from government institutions. Religions, for instance, can say that same-sex relationships are an abomination, or even very recently in our history, religions have argued that certain ethnic groups are disfavored by God. And this is one of the many reasons that religions are rightly excluded from government institutions. But in this particular Supreme Court case, the court majority, of course, led by the conservatives, argued that religion is just speech. Now, I do want to go back to your original question, which is, about the distinction between adult-led clubs, which Good News Clubs are. They're always led by adults. They have to be because those kids are so little.
A 6-year-old
And,
won't be able to
right,
initiate the verse for the
right.
day, I guess.
Exactly, and student-led clubs at the high school level. First of all, there's a huge difference in terms of development. A 6-year-old can't distinguish between an adult, what a teacher is teaching them during school,
They think the teacher wants them to learn that 5 plus 5 equals 10 during school. And at 2:20, if a teacher's coming in and teaching them that if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to go to hell, that kid is still going to think, even though it's right after the bell rings, the kid is going to think that that's what the school wants them to believe. So, and whereas kids at the high school level are, you know, just developmentally very different, they can distinguish between an after-school club and in-school curriculum. And the other thing is that, you know, I don't have a problem if kids at the high school level want to create a, you know, a fellowship of Christian athletes or Muslim athletes or Jewish athletes and get together after school and perform acts of worship or whatever and talk about their religion with their friends. That's fine with me. But that is very different from an adult coming into a school and telling the children, you know, religious doctrine is true. And telling them, you know, offering them points or prizes or candy for recruiting their peers to the club. It's a very different kind of thing. Now, at the, you know, at the high school level, there can be an issue when members of that, say, fellowship for Muslim athletes or Jewish athletes tries to make their activities a normal part of the school day, forcing every child in that school to take a stand, you know, during the day. That's very different than having a student-led after-school club, which I have absolutely no problem with. But there is a distinction here. And when, you know, occasionally I hear people try to collapse the issues and they're really very distinct and they take advantage of very distinct sort of legislative history.
And it seemed that you and no one in the community were able to understand exactly where the good news came from in terms of your school in particular, that nobody seemed to have invited them. They just sort of appeared out of nowhere. Do you have any more information now as to how they got there and how they decided to, obviously they choose almost any school that they can, but how did they end up in your school if no one invited them and they're adults coming in?
Thanks for asking that question. I wish that everybody who's listening could see this book that I'm holding up. It's called The Plan.
The Plan, oh boy.
And this is how it says, this is how they get into the schools. And it's 400 pages of tabbed material covering every single aspect of establishing a Good News Club in a public elementary school. Everything from, you know, a sample letter to the superintendent, sample letter to the principal, copy and save legal documents, publicity programs, you know, how to get kids involved. One of the ways that Good News Clubs, probably the primary way that Good News Clubs gets into public elementary schools is that they'll partner with a church that shares their theological viewpoint, that is sort of theologically aligned with their vision. And the church will recruit, you know, members to work for the club from their pews. You know, they see it as part of their job of fulfilling what's known as the Great Commission, or the what they see is the need to convert every person on earth to fundamentalist Christianity or evangelical Christianity in preparation for the second coming. So they will sort of find people to work at the Good News Club, and they go through a very extensive training that covers every single aspect of establishing a Good News Club in a public elementary school. Every single aspect, every single lesson plan. There is absolutely no room to fail, and there's no room whatsoever to deviate from the party line. So that's how they usually get into the public schools. They partner with this church, and all their legal paperwork has been very carefully thought through, and it's provided to them for free by an organization called the Liberty Council. But interestingly, the Liberty Council leadership was present at the National Convention of the Good Child Evangelism Fellowship, which is the group that is behind the Good News Clubs. And I had a chance to sort of hear a lot from their leadership about what it is they're really after. You know, are they really all about, you know, starting these lovely sounding clubs and teaching kids to be kind to their neighbors, or are they really after something else? And I learned an awful lot about that.
It seems that they're definitely after something else. That there was one story in particular, and I'm ashamed to say I can't remember the specific Bible story that you referenced, but it had to do with obeying God to the extent of killing people if he tells you to.
Right. Thanks for bringing that up. It's interesting. The Good News Club prints a 5-year curriculum that covers every minute of a, you know, 60-minute lesson of a Good News Club. And it's really very specific. People who teach them have to sign that they're going to teach it exactly as planned. So here's one sample lesson from the Good News Club. It's about, you know, the story of Saul and the Amalekites that you might remember from the Old Testament. I think
there
you referred to. In this story, God tells Saul to kill all of the Amalekites, including the children and the babies. And it's a really interesting lesson because the way, you know, it's a very complicated, contentious Old Testament Bible story, one that could be interpreted in many ways by different biblical scholars. But the problem with this story is it has a history of showing up when one sect, one religious sect or one ethnic group has set its sights on exterminating another. Hutus preached this story in Hutu churches before going out to kill the Tutsis in Northern Ireland. Catholics used it to justify slaughter of Protestants, and Protestants used it to justify slaughter of Catholics. These are just two of the many examples that this story has been used throughout history. So, but the question here, the relevant question is, how does the Good News Club choose to teach this particular story in Good News Clubs to, you know, 6 and 7 year old children? Well, they start by making it, really bringing it down to kids. If you're asked to do something, they say, mow the lawn, sweep the floor. How much of it do you need to do before you can say, I did it? Yes, you need to do all of it. If you only partly obey, you're actually being disobedient. And then they go into the story of Saul and the Amalekites. And Saul told, you know, God told Saul to kill all of the Amalekites, including the children, people, animals, every living thing. Nothing shall be clear. And the Good News Club manual reads, that was pretty clear, wasn't it? And then they go on to say that the Amalekites had heard about Israel's true and living God, but they refused to believe in him. Their sinful unbelief caused them to do wicked things. So they're telling children the lesson that the sin of disbelief is really the cause of this wickedness, and that Saul, you know, needs to kill all of them because God has told them to. And they explain that Saul actually killed all of them, including the children and the, you know, the children and the babies. They don't say that, but they say, you know, all the people and animals. But he saved the king, he committed a disobedience by saving the king, sort of failing to kill all of them. Mm. He killed all the, you know, the whole population except for the king. And they say, if only God, Saul had been willing to seek God for strength to obey, but Saul was more interested in doing things his way. So they explain that failing to kill all of them when God had given the order to kill all of them was a sin of disobedience. He deliberately disobeyed by keeping King Agag alive. And in three separate places in this lesson plan, the teaching statement, I'm reading it here, it says, have the children shout, God will help you obey. Hmm. And down here again, have children shout, God will help you obey. And in a third place in this teaching statement, they tell the teacher to make the children shout, God will help you obey. And they really, you know, want to bring this home that, you know, Samuel wanted Saul to see that partly obeying is disobeying. Saul has been willing to seek God for strength to obey completely. And then again, they bring it back to the kids. Seek God's strength when you're tempted to disobey. And so that this is really, you know, God gives you an order. If it's an order to kill everybody, you've got to obey it to the letter. And failure to do it completely is disobedience. So this is the kind of lesson that they're teaching to kids in public elementary schools, 5 and 6 year old kids.
That it's really scary to hear that.
It is scary. You know, there's an independent study of the Good News Club's 5-year curriculum, and it revealed thousands, I think 5,000 references to sin, approximately, more or less. Mm-hmm. Thousands of references to, so sin is emphasized, punishment, thousands of references to punishment, hundreds of references to hell. And in that same study, they found only 2 or 3 glancing references to the golden rule or the royal law, which is loving your neighbor as yourself.
Wow.
Now, this is a very particular interpretation of Christianity. I mean, I think it's frankly an interpretation that most Christians would find completely incomprehensible to them. And in fact, you know, they call themselves non-denominational, which is a very you know, it's a very soft, it sounds very nice, non-denominational, means right. we like everybody, you know, but that's not what it means. It, you know, most activists that I met who work with Good News Clubs believe that most Americans who call themselves Christians really aren't, including, you know, Episcopalians,
yes.
United Methodists, the Catholics, which I heard described as a whole other religion, which is really interesting. Can
wow.
I get into this for a second?
Yes, I mean, please.
I went to the National Convention of the Good News Club, and I went to all, they have all these seminars on converting different groups of kids, you know, different ethnic backgrounds, et cetera. So they have this one seminar that I went to called Reaching Out to the Hispanic Child, which apparently was really reaching out to the, trying to convert the children of Catholic families, I gathered. The woman who was the head of CF, one of the heads of CF Spanish Ministries, Claudia Calderon, she was explaining, you know, how to subvert the teachings that these kids are, you know, given as children of Catholic families so subtly so as not to alert the parents that the kids are actually being converted to a whole other religion. So she said, Hispanics grow up with a big Catholic belief. It's something their parents instill in them before they're born. They call themselves Christians. The priest told them, you know, you're Christians in this church. It's a very fine line. When the children tell me that they are Christians, they say they're Christians because they are born in a Catholic family. So she goes on, how do we make the children understand that being devout Catholic doesn't mean that they're the right kind of Christians and that being Christian Catholic is different? She says, one thing to remember when you're talking to them is to never, don't discredit the Catholic Church, at least not at the beginning. So I thought, you know, that was really interesting. I think if more mainline Christians understood what the Good News Club is really about, they would be more concerned about the fact that this particular religious group is basically exploiting a government institution, the public elementary schools, for the promotion and, in fact, subsidy of their own form of religion.
Well, what's really interesting about that is you referenced the Supreme Court case a while back, a Good News Club, Milford, that case. And something that occurs to me is that if it is just free speech and they allow this sort of free speech, including telling children that you must obey God, even if it means killing everybody, what would happen if a group like the KKK, for example, were to come into the school and teach the kids white supremacy?
Theoretically, if it were religion, they can't keep them out. But see, this, I think, goes back to a kind of a philosophical discussion about the meaning of the Establishment Clause as paired with a Free Exercise Clause. I mean, I reject the idea that religion is just a form of speech. And the idea that, you know, if you don't discriminate against religions, as long as everyone gets their ticket and no one gets a special dispensation, no one gets special preference, then, hey, you know, the school is just a forum. Let every group come in and get their crack at the kids. You know, we're talking public elementary schools. You know what? Public elementary schools are, you know, for everybody. And if our, you know, schools, public elementary schools, are to function effectively in a diverse society, we need to set aside our religious agendas, our political agendas, whatever, and come together in support of our children and their future. You know, I mean, we have so many places to practice our faith, if any, you know, houses of worship, private businesses, homes, public parks, you know, any number of other places. We really don't need to be turning our public elementary schools into, you know, needless religious battlegrounds.
Yeah, and it's interesting you use the word battleground, because I remember somewhere in your book you talk about how the people at the Child Evangelism Fellowship actually refer to the public schools in general as being a battlefield. But the very strange thing about that is that they're shooting many of the bullets in a way, because they come into the schools, almost force their way into the schools, and then pretend that somehow it is fair and honest, when in fact, as you experienced directly when you went to one of their conferences, it is all about, it's all about marketing, it's all about trickery, and it's all about raising kids in that I think it was 5 to 14 window, ages 5 to 14, when they're the most vulnerable. It seems there's nothing remotely honest about that.
That's true. I think that there's, to an extent to which many people fail to appreciate, there's a certain segment of fundamentalist Christianity that has never accepted public education as legitimate enterprise to begin with. They see public schools, I believe, because they're reason-based rather than faith-based or fact-based, and because they teach critical thinking skills, they think that that is hostile to their form of religion. And if they, can't, force their way and into the schools and repurpose the schools with their particular religious agenda, they would be happy to just destroy the schools altogether. In 1979, Jerry Falwell made the agenda transparent. He said, "I hope to see the day when, as in the early days of our country, we don't have public schools. The churches will have taken them over again, and Christians will be running them." And fundamentalist leaders today, such as Tony Perkins, echo this. I think it was just a couple of days ago, he came out with, I get their mail, and he came out with some statement about how the government schools, they call them government schools, are,
It's always a bad
just
word.
so terrible, just teaching children terrible things like evolution and critical thinking skills, and just how bad this is. So indeed, the leaders of the Child Evangelism Fellowship are not out to help the schools. I heard an enormous amount of hostility expressed to public schools at their national convention when I was listening in particular to the speech of Matt Staver. He's the president and founder of Liberty Council, and that's the organization that provides them with their free legal backing. And this is one thing he says. He said, "Often we drive by the public schools and the tanks are there on the playground." He's speaking sort of metaphorically. "Bullets are being hurled over their heads as they're in the classrooms. The mushroom clouds are billowing. We don't understand the warfare and battle that is going on for the children." And he basically talks about how, uses that to segue into talking about how, it's a battle between two nations. And he says, if someone, as someone who studies humanity, you want to look at where you're going to put your energy in, you focus on the one tiny thing in the cabin there that will ultimately change the rudder to change the entire cruise ship's direction. You focus on the youth. He said, it is the most strategic age group that we have. And he sort of summed up this speech where he's sort of rallying his troops to battle for the minds of these children. He said, of other people's children, mind you. He says, knock down all the doors, all the barriers to all the 65,000 plus elementary schools in the country and take the gospel to this open mission field now, not later, now. Let's march forward. Let's ratchet up the heat to another level. So
Wow.
they're really, they really think of themselves as in a spiritual battle. And what they're going for is other people's children. They're not just going for their own kids. They're going after other people's kids. And this is something that I think really kind of struck me. The religious right wing often act as though they're the last defenders of the American family, but
Yes.
they treat families like mine with contempt. And they, they see no, they have no hesitation in interfering in the families that do not look like theirs.
It's a very bizarre view, and it seems to be a fight not solely for Christianity and for their particular version of Christianity, but a fight against difference, a fight against rational thinking, a fight
It
against
is.
science.
And the amazing thing is, they're doing it by trying to split up other people's families,
Yes.
setting the children against their parent.
I am reminded so much by my old teacher back in high school. One of the first things he told us was that a town like Kearney, where I grew up, Kearney, New Jersey, about 10 miles west of Manhattan, he said, we have great public schools as far as qualified teachers and stuff like that, but there's a lot of disparity when it comes to worldviews. I didn't think about it at the time because I was 16 years old, but that perspective was suggesting that, remember, disparity when it comes to worldviews, the very idea that people have viewpoints other than an evangelical Christian perspective
mm-hmm.
is in their minds, or it seems to be in their minds, to be an attack directly on them and directly on their religion. And what one thing I was really wondering through reading this book, and of course, as I'm trying to write a book about that experience that I had back in high school now, I connected the two, and I'm still trying to figure out, are these people really believers in the idea that everyone who doesn't agree and promote their particular view is attacking them? Or is this more just a little bit more of a ploy, something that they are aware that they are making up, but they don't actually feel? And I still can't figure out what that is. But being that you met a number of these people, especially at their conference, I wonder if you have any ideas. You obviously don't have an absolute answer, but it strikes me as very strange that they would actually see it this way.
That there's a persecution complex, and every happy holidays is a bullet in a religious war rather
yes.
than a happy holidays, including mine and yours and everyone else's.
Right.
Yes, indeed. I have a lot to say about that. And it's interesting that you brought that up. Where do I begin? I think there is often a difference between the people, sort of the ground troops, and the people who are the big picture thinkers behind it. I think that the leadership of religious extremists have really used the language of and the tactics of the civil rights movement against people who are sort of moderate and progressive. There's actually a wonderful book about this tactic. It started as a legal tactic, Rob Boston, who is the mm-hmm. one of the heads of Americans United, he wrote this fantastic book called, can't even remember the title of the book. This is quite embarrassing. I know that the subtitle is Why the Religious Right is Wrong. But it's basically how they turned the language and logic of the civil rights movement on its head and said, well, that strategy of claiming to be an oppressed minority has really worked very well for truly oppressed minorities. And so we're going to adopt those tactics and, promote ourselves as this sort of persecuted and discriminated against group. And so that anything that, the way they construe it, anything that fails to affirm them in their particular worldview is oppressing. And look, I mean, how do you want to, the best way, I think, to make a liberal retreat is to accuse them of being intolerant. And the religious right is very good at doing that. They say, well, if we can't, stand from the rooftops and insist that everyone says Merry Christmas, well, then you are actually oppressing us. I mean, it's completely, frankly, I believe it's paranoid and is not borne out by the facts. But they've used this tactic both, in the courts and also in the just culturally, and it's working very well for them.
Well, for those of you just tuning in, I'm Matthew DeClaire, and you're listening to Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM, and my guest today is Catherine Stewart, the author of The Good News Club. And it seems that, for whatever reason, when these topics come up in the press, a lot of times you end up seeing the story painted as, here is one side of the argument, here is the other side of the argument.
Right. The earth is flat, the earth is round. Discuss.
Right. Yeah, and I can't figure out exactly why it is that they, I guess I do, I have figured out why it is. It's because they've shifted the conversation a little bit more in their favor, where it becomes a little bit more of a reasonable thing to have these arguments. And I suppose that when you have a little bit over, I think it's a quarter of Americans who self-identify as being evangelical Christians, mm-hmm. you're bound to have that sort of power, especially with the amount of money that they have too.
You're absolutely right about that. They have combined budgets of over $100 million per year. And inserting their viewpoint, repurposing public schools to reflect a fundamentalist Christian agenda is one of their big pushes, not just repurposing the public schools, but also defunding them simultaneously by promoting voucher schemes that will divert money from public schools and funnel them into private religious schools instead. So they get a lot of their money from large donors. For instance, James Leininger, who's sort of the granddaddy of the religious right in Texas, one of the big funders, I believe he's putting a lot of money right now into, he's supporting Ted Cruz, and he has supported Rick Perry in the past and a panoply of other politicians and causes. The Edgar and Elsa Prince Foundation, their son founded Blackwater, Eric Prince founded Blackwater, which is a sort of private military organization. I believe the Amundsen, there was an Amundsen Foundation, I think it's called, Bolt House. I mean, there are a number of large companies that support these legal groups. As far as how the Child Evangelism Fellowship gets money to put on Good News Clubs, it works in many ways like a multi-level marketing scheme. The money actually flows from the bottom up. Of course, they get donations, and they get, you know, people die and leave their, you know, bequeath, you know, the CEF in their wills and things like that. But the way they raise money is that they partner with churches theologically aligned with their mission. And in order to lead a Good News Club, the leaders have to raise up $20,000 per club. And they'll raise it from people in their church or people who are, again, you know, like-minded religious people. And the money they raise goes is to purchasing curriculum equipment, other kinds of equipment for the Good News Club. Snacks, of course, every Good News Club I attended had, you know, huge volume of junk food, you know, so that kids could, and, you know, sometimes balloons. And then some of the money that they raise goes to the state office, and another percentage goes to the national office. So the money sort of flows up the chain. And if you think about it, that's right now there are nearly 4,000 Good News Clubs in public elementary schools around the country, and 20,000 per club, that's like $80 million per year that's flowing into the organization. This is quite a lot of money.
It sounds like a lot of money, and I guess that explains the very ridiculous amount of food too that they keep bringing. I find that to be a really it's a minor point, but it seems so cheap.
Well, as a, you know, my kids would do anything for a cupcake.
Who wouldn't do anything for a cupcake?
I would do anything.
It's, you know, it's part of life. I mean, I know that's usually what they always told us to do, even in high school, if we wanted to have a club, because people will usually come, especially if there's some free food. I have a hard time believing that people like Justice Scalia would look at a case in which a Jewish child is being told that he or she will burn in hell for eternity, and a parent has a problem with that because the student is being told inside of their public school. Do you think that maybe a group like the Child Evangelism Fellowship maybe caught a break in the Milford case, and that perhaps in the future things might be able to change, or that a different case might be able to at least put some more restrictions on these people? Because I can't imagine most people who have an iota of rationality within their being would find it acceptable to do this to young kids, especially in a public school, when we have already established that religion does not have a place inside of a public school when it is promoted by school officials or by people who can be perceived as school officials.
I don't think they caught a break at all. I think Scalia and Thomas knew exactly what they were doing in this case. Look, in his majority opinion in the case, Thomas actually laid out a philosophy that essentially destroyed a post-war consensus that we used to have on the separation of church and school. It was the first thing they did was redefine religion as nothing more than speech from a religious viewpoint. I mean, it's incomprehensible. It doesn't make any sense. It shouldn't. Religion is not just speech from a certain point of view. It's religion.
Especially, I would think, to a dedicated Christian.
Yes.
It would seem the exact opposite.
You know, they put themselves in a position basically to construe the exclusion of the club as on the grounds that it is a religious activity, that excluding religious activity is a form of discrimination against its religious viewpoint. It just doesn't make any sense at all. Thomas wrote that he could see no logical difference in kind between the invocation of Christianity by the club and the invocation of teamwork, loyalty, or patriotism by, say, a soccer club. And actually, when you're talking about the divisiveness, by the way, soccer clubs are subject to the same kind of, you know, taxes and non-discrimination laws and other things that religions are not subject to. So there is a significant distinction, which the government already acknowledges. And it, as far as the division that the club involves, Scalia, he just he belittled this. He said so-called peer pressure, even if it could be considered coercion, he said it was immaterial to the case. And he mocked, quote, Justice Stevens's fears that the club's actions might prove, and then he put in parentheses, shudder, divisive, you know. So he doesn't seem to think that the fact that clubs are divisive in the public elementary school area, he didn't see this as concerning at all. Well, and look, the courts used to acknowledge the coercive effect of religion. I want to read you a quote from a very different Supreme Court justice, Frankfurter, who explained, I believe it was in 1947, he explained in, I think it was the McCollum decision, any activity that sharpens the consciousness of religious differences among children in public schools, he wrote, causes precisely the consequences against which the Constitution was directed when it prohibited the government common to all from being embroiled, becoming embroiled, however innocently, in the destructive religious conflicts of which even the history of this country records some dark pages. So, you know, the courts used to acknowledge the fact that the schools have a kind of cloak of authority in the minds of children, and that we actually want the schools to function effectively and serve all children. And we're not allowed to insert adult-led political clubs in the public schools, and nobody complains that that is discriminating against their viewpoint. I mean, student-led clubs, as we've discussed earlier, at the high school level is a completely different story. The sort of religious liberty lobby, you know, is now claiming that to, you know, harmonious public elementary schools are no longer, they no longer matter, and that adults are allowed to get in there and get their crack at the kids. It's hard for me, for instance, to imagine that a group of free thinkers would start a club that teaches that belief in religion is nothing but superstition and specifically instructs their kids to go after churched kids and tell them that their families' are beliefs are superstitious and false. I mean, that would be unbelievably rude, for one thing. I would never tell my children to go specifically go find kids who believe and tell them that their parents are really, you know, they've got these false beliefs here.
That's a good point.
That would be interfering in the spiritual integrity of another family. And if it hadn't been the evangelical Christians who did this, for instance, if it was a member of a minority group, if it were, say, for instance, you know, especially one of the religious minorities that are tend to get a lot of negative press, that people would have gone absolutely mad, and this never would have been allowed. What I've learned in my research is that when other religious groups attempt to exercise their rights, or so-called rights, in the same way that majority, or at least perceived majority religions do, they're shut down, if not by law, then convention. And I'll give you a couple of examples. There was a group of, you know, the Gideons have been distributing Bibles in public schools, or trying to for many years.
Yes.
So in Miami, Oklahoma, they were distributing Bibles in one of the public schools, and a Muslim family decided they were going to do the same thing with Qurans. They said, oh, the forum is open, you know, you can distribute Bibles in the schools. Well, we'll distribute our sacred texts in the schools too. And they, you know, received so much hate mail that they, you know, had to go into hiding for a time. And another instance is that in, I think it was it Virginia? There was a church was distributing vacation Bible clubs in public schools. And one of the leaders of the Camp Quest, which is an atheist or a free camp, we're going to distribute Camp Quest flyers. And first they were told they couldn't do it by the school. And they said, well, actually, since you've already distributed vacation Bible clubs, since you've already opened the forum, you have to let us do it too. Otherwise, you're discriminating. So they were allowed to do it. And the school received so much hate mail that their server shut down. And then after that, they shut down the sort of forum altogether. They didn't allow anybody to distribute these after-school flyers. And so these are just two of the many, many examples that I've heard that when minority groups try to exercise their rights in the same way that these fundamentalist Christians have been able to, because they call themselves Christian. Everybody thinks they're mainstream, even though they're not. The minority groups are really not able to do it.
So we're talking about some really heavy stuff. That's the only way I could put it for right now, because it's a little bit hard to swallow. Even this is the second time that I've spoken with you about this topic, and it really strikes me as being a serious problem because it's directed at young children. When you were invited to these, it sounds like you might not have been necessarily invited, but when you went to these conferences and you met many of the people, not only the people who were up on stage giving lectures and speeches, but also just the people on the ground listening, did you get the sense that everyone was on the same page, or that there were people who were in the group that were just sort of going along with what they were being told?
You know, I met a lot of really lovely people who work for the Good News Clubs. I met a lot of people who do the work on the ground, teaching the clubs, who seem to really, I think they really mean well for the children that they're working with and the communities in which they're working. But unfortunately, I think their efforts, all their good intentions are being harnessed in service of an agenda that will ultimately erode our communities and degrade our public schools and undermine our public schools. I mean, I think the goal of the national movement behind the assault on public schools is to turn America into a so-called Christian nation as defined by them. And, you know, I'm concerned that that they're going to, as they continue this assault, they're really going to damage the public schools. And I see that they already have. Look, when a group like a Good News Club, a fundamentalist group that sets child against child and child against their own parents, commandeers the public resources for the promotion of their agenda, other members of the community start to think that that public school is maybe not a place where they're welcome after all, and they start to feel a bit disenfranchised, and they start to withdraw their support. They start to withdraw their emotional support, their money, their time. They stop perhaps donating as many man hours to the science fairs and things like that that they used to contribute to, or volunteering in the homeroom. I saw this start to happen in my own child's public school when we heard that a Good News Club was coming. You know, all of a sudden this, you know, used to walk. One of the parents who I wrote about said to me, you know, it used to be, you know, I'd walk into the playground. We were all school parents together. And now I walk into the playground and everybody's divided into their little groups. I look around and they're, you know, you're a Christian, you're the right kind of Christian, you're the wrong kind of Christian, you're a Buddhist, you're a Muslim, you're an atheist. And so parents start to kind of, you know, it divides the public school community, and it erodes support for the public school community altogether. And look, it would be nice to think that the harm to the school community is an unintended consequence of the activity of a Good News Club. But unfortunately, I think it is precisely part of the plan. I really think that there is a two-pronged plan they have to destroy public schools, which is what, I mentioned earlier, Jerry Falwell said was his ultimate goal. Repurpose them with a fundamentalist Christian agenda, number one, and number two, destroy support for the public schools altogether, defund them. And I've seen this over and over in communities where, you know, when Good News Clubs enter a diverse school community.
Was there anything else that you found while you were watching how they were training people to become foot soldiers for the organization in their promotion of these views?
Well, trying to think of what sort of popped out at me, what kind of unusual thing. I think the thing that popped out at me the most was how standardized a lot of the lesson plans are. Even the jokes, the same jokes that are told in Good News Clubs in Seattle are the jokes that are being told in, you know, Good News Clubs in Florida. There's just an incredible standardization of the lessons, standardization of the training. And what was really interesting to me is that the process for becoming a Good News Club teacher was incredibly intense, and you have to fill out this incredible, you know, number of forms, and basically agree to, doctrinal purity. You have to submit very incredibly personal, incredibly detailed references from your pastor. And the one thing that stuck out at me the most was that there was an attitude. I mean, there was a question that the pastor has to fill out, which is, what is the applicant's attitude toward the authority? I thought this was the most important question, because this is the thing. This is a very authoritarian organization. This CEF wants followers. And by having these very grueling applications, it seeks out people who are eager to submit. And what it offers in return for this kind of submission is pretty clear. It promises people who embrace their servitude, it promises them a kind of mastery of their own. They're going to gain control, perhaps, of their own doubts in their faith. But more to the point, they're going to get the chance to exercise authority over the minds of other people's children. And I think that that's pretty, pretty astonishing.
From the perspective of a group and the people who are in the Child Evangelism Fellowship and other organizations like it, I suppose that in some respect they see things like the teaching of evolution as being a similar type of danger, that we are, as a nation, teaching children from a very young age to accept this particular view. When I think about it from that perspective, obviously it's different, because one is based in a lot of evidence, science, critical thinking. We can also prove it, and we can watch it, and we can see it happen in things like fruit flies and that. But even so, just the concept of teaching kids from a very young age, I can understand why, if you are to truly believe in the idea that, for example, if God tells you to kill everybody, you do it, and you do it without question. I suppose that from that perspective, something like the teaching of evolution is quite dangerous and is quite harmful. Since that is the case, what on earth do we do with groups like this and these people who are out there promoting these viewpoints in the public schools, often without the support of the community?
What can be done?
Yes, well, that's a hard question.
It's a hard question, but there's a lot that can be done. And I think the first thing that can be done is that we can't begin to face our challenges as a society until people know that it's actually happening. So I think it's really important for people to educate themselves and others about the fundamentalism, the extremism at the heart of the Good News Clubs. And to, when a group comes in saying it's just, Bible study from a non-denominational standpoint and sounds so harmless, it's really important to sort of shed some light on this situation. Who exactly are they? And when you look, reading my book is obviously a great way to start, but there are other resources out there. So that's number one. Number two, I think there's a role for school boards to play in introducing, for instance, anti-bullying programs that specifically address the issue of faith-based mm-hmm. bullying and bigotry, that specifically address issues of religious bigotry and bullying. And that will kind of help to counteract the any sort of bigoted messages that might be spread through these kinds of clubs. I think it's really important to, if you're a parent, to prepare your kids for the kind of bullying and bigotry that inevitably arise when a group like this comes into the public school environment. But, in a larger, a longer term issue, I'd really like to see a legal strategy pursued from a progressive standpoint, which reaffirms the distinction between worship, religious worship and religion and speech, and which acknowledges the coercive effect of the school environment on young kids. And look, the religious extremists have advanced their agenda very successfully through the courts. And I would like
to... They're not giving up either.
They're not giving up.
I've seen a number of stories recently where they continue to make the same push over and over again.
Yes, they do continue to make the same push over and over again. And it really comes back to, what was it that our founding fathers believed in when it comes to, when they wrote the Establishment Clause? Thomas Jefferson wrote a couple of quotes in his famous letter to the Danbury Baptists. He wrote, Religion is between an individual and their deity, more or less, I think that's a quote, on the one hand, he said, and also religion can concern itself only with actions, not thoughts. So the wall of separation that he was referring to there, and what he coined that term wall of separation, was really understood to keep religion out of government, you know, and public schools are a government institution. And by installing a Good News Club or any kind of religious club in a public elementary school, you're basically using the power of government to meddle in what I believe the exclusive right and concern of the individual, as Jefferson understood it.
So the last question I'll ask you is about the release of your book, The Good News Club. Since you went to many of these meetings and you met a number of the people who were involved in these organizations, did you receive any reaction from those groups after the book came out?
I've actually, you know, it's interesting. I've published a lot of articles, a lot of, since the book came out, I've written for The Atlantic, The Guardian, Reuters, Religion Dispatches, a bunch of other places, The New York Times. And the one of my pieces in The Guardian was about the teachings of the Good News Club. It was about specifically teachings on their Amalekites session, the Amalekites, you know, lesson plan. And I got a letter from the piece I wrote, got a letter from Reese Kaufman, who was the president of the Child Evangelism Fellowship. And he made assertions, but he seemed really unfamiliar with his own teaching materials. And I can't remember exactly the exchange, he said stuff that just was completely untrue, because it didn't reflect the teaching materials that are actually in the lesson plans. So, and then I did point that out, the fact that he didn't seem familiar with the teaching materials, and here is what they actually say. And that's been the only official response I've received. I have to say I've had a lot of really lovely conversations with people who disagree with my conclusions or my point of view. I welcome these kinds of conversations if they're civil and people can speak to each other in a respectful way. But, you know, even more than that, I've received a huge amount of support from large numbers of parents of a variety of backgrounds that agree with my, you know, Christian and non-Christian, religious and non-religious, who all agree that, you know, public schools are one of the foundations of our democracy. You know, in a way, they're like the silent pillar of our democracy. And indeed, if they're to function effectively in a society as, you know, diverse as ours, then we need to all set aside whatever religious agenda we may have and come together and support our kids in our schools and work hard for them to have a good collective future.
I think that's a great place for us to end the interview. Not only that, but we're running out of time. So
okay.
Thanks very much for coming on the show today. That was Catherine Stewart, author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. You can go out, find it on a number of websites. Check it out.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to speak with you again.
And that was Equal Time for Free Thought. If you missed any part of our show, you can visit our website at equaltimeforfreethought.org. Certainly spread it around, share it with friends, and remember to tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.